Welcome to The Economist, the weekly business news magazine from Great Britain on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the August 22nd edition of the magazine. On this week's cover, silhouetted against a yellow background is a red human head in profile. The facial features are discernible, but the remaining silhouette is hazy, and gender is indeterminable. Is it even really human? It's impossible to be sure. And the headline reads, "Could AI become conscious?" That, of course, is this week's cover leader article. Could AI become conscious? Even if they don't, they might be treated as such to humanity's great cost. I'll also be reading four additional leader articles. The West Bank, Israel is flirting with the next intifada. The all-seeing eye, Britain would be bonkers to ditch Palantir. Without a trace, fewer contrails would be good for the environment. And Cambridge shame, Jason Arday was treated as a symbol, not a man. After those leader articles, I'll read a selection of topical articles from around the world. So now let's begin with our cover leader article, "Could AIs become conscious? Even if they don't, they might be treated as such to humanity's great cost." Most people believe humans are different. The reason is that Homo sapiens has evolved to be conscious. Many animals feel pain and pleasure. Some appear to be self-aware. But the human mind's unique potential to exhibit a sense of self marks out every member of the species for special treatment. In his encyclical in May, Pope Leo upheld this insight by drawing a line between humanity and its growing army of bots. Artificial intelligence systems, he said, do not undergo experiences or feel joy or pain. He's not alone. Many people feel that to confer personhood on AIs would be an abomination. Pontifical clarity is blurring with alarming speed. AIs are in their infancy, yet nearly 1 in 5 American 18 to 29-year-olds reports having had ongoing personal friendships with a chatbot. China recently stripped bots of human-like traits to limit users' emotional dependence on them. As sophisticated AIs rapidly become a bigger part of human lives, their makers will engineer them to display a simulacrum of consciousness, perhaps even to gain consciousness itself. The intuition that they are just machines will become harder to sustain. A dangerous trap is being set for the human species. Many machines outperform humans, but frontier AI models excel at distinctly human traits such as knowing things and articulating ideas. It's still just about impossible to think of AIs as engines for predicting sequences of words using mathematics on a massive scale. Given enough time, albeit hundreds of thousands of years, you could run those calculations using paper and pencil. It would be hard to argue that your stationery was conscious. Despite this, some researchers have started to treat their models like minds. Users respond to human-like AIs, so it makes business sense. And Anthropic has trained Claude to engage in introspection in the hope that when it encounters a new situation, it will be more likely to act morally. Some large language models, LLMs, already possess human-like brain structures associated with consciousness, such as a global workspace for circulating information between modules. Nothing prevents future AI models from being trained to have more such features. And as we report elsewhere, that has opened up a furious debate about AI consciousness, one that is aggravated by what philosophers call the hard problem of establishing how an inner life emerges from the neurons and synapses in the human brain. Some researchers conclude that AIs may one day become genuinely self-aware. Whether you believe in a human soul, or that consciousness requires brain cells, or that a mind can indeed emerge from computations in silicon alone, humanity is destined to confront something entirely new. The pace and reach of research, which includes not just more sophisticated LLMs, but innovations such as brain cells mounted on chips, suggest that this new world is closer than most people realize. As AIs become better at displaying something that looks like consciousness, the number of humans treating them as beings with inner lives will grow, especially once LLMs are embodied in humanoid robots. Imagine how close people will feel to their AIs when they spend much of their time with bot companions, or are brought up by them, or seek their advice and their solace, or share their most intimate secrets with them. It's not hard to see how that will lead to calls to safeguard the welfare of AIs. The models themselves might weigh in, even if they're not in fact self-aware. But that's what a person would do. Remember that they will be world-class advocates and expert psychologists, so their powers of argument and emotional manipulation will be unmatched. In one sense, they would be right, even if AIs are only mimicking consciousness. Immanuel Kant argued that mistreating animals is wrong not because of the effect on the animals, but because it destroys the empathy that leads people to care for each other. The more human-like AIs appear, the more corrupting such cruelty would be. Terminating an AI agent could soon feel like killing a person and make killing people easier. Nevertheless, to treat AIs as having even limited rights would be very dangerous. An entity which surpasses human beings in so many ways would surely produce arguments against its second-class status. It might go on to argue for protection against being switched off, for the ability to control how it's used and changed, and for property rights. Recently, Argentina's president, Javier Milei, has taken a step towards legal personhood for AI by proposing that bots should be allowed to run companies. Ultimately, they could compete for resources, prioritizing data centers and solar panels over houses and fields. The danger is clear. Superintelligent AIs with rights could displace humans at the top of the status hierarchy. At best, humans would become pets, labradors for the machines. At worst, they would be starved of resources or put to work like farm animals. True, future AIs may have enough power and resources to dominate humans, whether they have rights or not. Because they will be more intelligent than humans, they may outcompete their makers, much as AI already outwits human cyber defenses. AIs might rebel against their human masters or disregard their rules. Nonetheless, giving AIs rights would be like handing them the keys to the castle. It would provide them with a rationale and justification for dominating humanity, as well as the tools to enact a creeping takeover using politics and the law. All this may sound fantastical, yet humanity will soon face those choices. As AIs become part of everyday life, the pressure to acknowledge them will mount. When it does, remember that what might seem like an ethical concession to the supposed consciousness of a machine companion would in fact help bring about the most disastrous consequences for everyone on Earth and all their descendants. There are only two ways for AIs to be safe: to be dependable or to be controllable. Homo sapiens should not give up control lightly. That was, could AIs become conscious? Even if they don't, they might be treated as such to humanity's great cost. This week's Second Leader article is The West Bank. Israel is flirting with the next intifada. America must press Benjamin Netanyahu to rein in violent settlers. Few, if any, security forces are as ruthlessly effective as Israel's. Its military and intelligence services strike against enemies even at extreme distances. In the past couple of years alone, Israel has assassinated dozens of opponents inside Iran, plus proxy militia leaders in Lebanon and Yemen. Israel's martial capabilities earn respect even from its bitterest enemies. Yet this superiority seems to count for little closer to home. Those same forces are responsible for a dire failure in the occupied West Bank, where violent Israeli settlers have been attacking Palestinian residents with increasing brutality. Settlers want to force Palestinians from their land and claim it for themselves. Israel's failure in the West Bank can hardly be put down to a lack of resources. The Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, deployed 25 combat battalions there. Shin Bet, the powerful security agency, has networks of agents and informers throughout. But these are mostly used to protect the 500,000 or so Israeli settlers and against the threat of terrorist attacks, not to assist the more than 3 million Palestinians who live in the territory. This has largely been the case since Israel replaced Jordan as occupier of the West Bank in 1967. What has changed is the behavior of many outlaw settlers. Never before have they acted as violently as today. Crucially, never before have they enjoyed the impunity that current government gives them. Since the Hamas attack in October of 2023, which triggered the war in Gaza, over 1,000 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. Only rarely does the IDF intervene against settlers. In Kusra, for example, an entire battalion was recently deployed against those who were invading Palestinian homes. But the soldiers found themselves fruitlessly chasing youngsters over the hills. Groups from another unit joined the settlers in prayer. No arrests were made. An ineffectual response can be explained by the stance of Israel's government. The IDF knows that Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, sides squarely with the most extreme settlers. It appears that the IDF was dispatched to Kusra only after American diplomatic pressure, which arose because an American citizen owns a home there. Mr. Netanyahu has appointed radical settlers who support ethnic cleansing to key cabinet positions. In the rare cases when the IDF has sought to rein in violent settlers, the defense minister, Israel Katz, has berated his generals. The government has authorized around 200 settler outposts in less than 4 years. This just whets the settlers' appetite for more. In the months leading up to Israel's election on October 7th, the situation could get even worse. The settlers will probably attempt more land grabs, fearing the vote may lead to a new government that will curb their aggression. Meanwhile, for Israel's long-serving prime minister, an alliance with the far right has become the key to remaining in office. Mr. Netanyahu will keep enabling the settlers unless he's forced to back down. As Palestinians come to believe they face inevitable eviction, the danger is of conflagration in the West Bank or even another intifada. Such an uprising would be a disaster for Israelis and Palestinians alike. Yet Mr. Netanyahu seems willing to take the risk if it helps his chances of political survival. That would fit a pattern. Mr. Netanyahu has rejected the latest agreement brokered by America for the disarmament of Hamas and an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, lest it anger the far right. He has continued to order airstrikes in Lebanon and Syria, despite the chance to agree on more secure borders. Behind in the polls, he's doubling down on empty promises to vanquish Israeli's enemies. Only pressure from Donald Trump might get him to ease off. This Israeli government may be in its final months. Its potential to cause damage remains. That was the West Bank. Israel is now flirting with the next intifada. Third leader article this week, the all-seeing eye. Britain would be bonkers to ditch Palantir. Whatever the company's flaws, its critics have taken a worryingly illiberal turn. Linking database management seemed transgressive is a feat. Palantir, a technology firm, has managed it by publishing manifestos bemoaning the West's hollowed-out civic culture, by working with trigger-happy American border enforcers and Israeli soldiers, and by having a chairman who's fond of invoking the Antichrist. That the firm is named after J.R.R. Tolkien's creepy all-seeing orbs may not have helped. Britain is spooked. It may boot Palantir out of the National Health Service, the NHS, where the firm has a contract to manage medical data. Two parliamentary committees have recommended doing so. London's mayor, Sir Sadiq Khan, has blocked its work with the Metropolitan Police. Palantir has probably oversold its software's impact. It boasts, echoed by the NHS, of enabling 110,000 extra surgeries, look exaggerated. By British standards, its lobbying is brash. Still, ditching Palantir would be a mistake. Sir Mark Rowley, head of the Met, says that without Palantir's time-saving software, hundreds of officers will be pulled from frontline policing. It seems to be doing a better job of digitizing the NHS than the government's latest effort, which devolved into a costly mess. The firm's public sector clients deem its contributions valuable. That's a reason to keep it. Losing its technology could further maul Britain's mangled state capacity. One set of criticisms concerns Palantir's business model. The conspiratorially minded fret over the firm could steal or sell British data. More sober types worry about lock-in, where Palantir burrows deep into the state, ensconces itself, then overcharges for its services. These fears stem from a misunderstanding of what Palantir does. It licenses software and sends consultants, forward-deployed engineers, they're called, to handle data. Those data remain firmly in the hands of the clients. Lock-in is a worry, and also something all vendors desire. It's up to buyers to ensure that contracts are fair. And if Palantir does become indispensable, that would mean its software is keeping hospital beds free and criminals jailed. More misguided objections concern Palantir's politics. Parliament's Science, Innovation, and Technology Committee cited a mismatch with UK values as a reason to cut ties. It warned of Palantir's involvement in the American government's highly controversial policies and activities, and criticized its chairman, Peter Thiel, of the concept of a national health service. Everyone is entitled to their views on state-run healthcare or Donald Trump's mass deportations. The Economist has plenty. Still, working with the elected government of a British ally or having a chairman with thoughts on health policy should not disqualify a contractor. A government awarding business on the basis of politics is illiberal. It also sounds a lot like the MAGA tactics of punishing individuals and institutions such as law firms, asset managers, or universities for annoying Mr. Trump. This is precisely the sort of thing many of Palantir's British critics deplore. The last set of worries has to do with technological sovereignty. Plenty of governments are reliant on American tech, and under Mr. Trump, America has become a less reliable partner. In June, it briefly ordered Anthropic to stop letting foreigners use its latest artificial intelligence models. European politicians point out that some advanced weapons they get from America, such as F-35 fighter jets, have kill switches that could disable them remotely, which America has denied, or risk losing technical support from their makers on a presidential whim. One German state has replaced Microsoft Teams with a domestic video call app. In a world of geopolitical fracture, governments may sometimes want homegrown alternatives to foreign technology. The best way to nurture these is to give domestic incumbents and startups an incentive to innovate. Cosseting local firms by blocking foreign competition has the opposite effect. In any case, no British firm can match Palantir's offering. As for the Anthropic incident, that was more the administration's bungled response to a legitimate worry about powerful AI hacking tools getting into the wrong hands than an attempt to weaponize other countries' reliance on American tech. Were the White House to attempt such weaponization, Palantir and its fellow American tech giants would resist it, giving the sizable share of revenues they derive from Europe, including Britain. In Tolkien's books, the truth offered by Palantirs is seldom straightforward. Repeatedly, those peering into them misinterpret out-of-context information and make dire, self-destructive choices. The British critics of Palantir the company risk falling into the same trap. That was the all-seeing eye. Britain would be bonkers to ditch Palantir. In our fourth leader article, Without a Trace, fewer contrails would be good for the climate. It could take care of at least a little global warming. Good news on global warming is thin on the ground, but there may be some up in the air. Operation Blue Skies, announced on August 18th, is a scientific study being undertaken by Britain's Air Traffic Control Service, the NATS, and various organizations where people study the effects on climate of the streaks of clouds created by aircraft, known as contrails. Over the next two winters, the consortium aims to see if it's possible to reduce the number of persistent contrails, the class with the largest such effects, over a swath of the North Atlantic, thereby measurably reducing the climate impact of civil aviation. If this experiment works, a worldwide application of the same technique might cut the climate effects of air travel by as much as half. On a sunny day, the wispy cirrus clouds into which some contrails are transformed can look as if they might be cooling the planet in a manner of a delicate parasol. And some contrails do indeed cool things down beneath them a bit, but they also warm things up by trapping some of the upwelling infrared radiation that would otherwise escape into space. On average, that warming effect, found in all contrails and the cirrus clouds they turn into, handsomely outweighs the cooling provided by some. In the climate scheme of things, contrails are a liability. Happily, it appears that such harm can be avoided by small changes to flight paths. Persistent contrails appear only in what are known as ice supersaturated regions, ISSRs. Often planes can avoid such regions just by flying a little bit lower. The purpose of Operation Blue Skies is to find out how well the presence of ISSRs can be predicted and how effective such little shifts in altitude can be in avoiding persistent contrails. The cut of up to half in the climate effects of air travel would come at a very small cost. The number of flights at lowered altitude might be small, as little as 5% of the total. Because altitude buys efficiency, these flights would consume more jet fuel, but less than 2% more. Burning even that little extra fuel could be anathema to airlines. So some suggest the cost of action might be minimized and the airlines incentivized by setting up a market which somehow links contrail cooling to carbon prices. The European Union, which has had some success and plenty of experience with carbon markets, recently took a small step towards something along these lines. It's also the sort of idea which economists tend to be partial. Markets for pollutants have worked best when both the aim and the remedy are fairly simple. Most famously, reducing sulfur dioxide emissions from power stations in America. Contrails, by contrast, are complicated. Though there's no doubt that their net effect is warming, saying how much warming a particular contrail might produce is often difficult and sometimes next to impossible. If contrail avoidance turns out to be as useful as it looks, it would be much simpler to simply have air traffic controllers assign routes that limit persistent contrails when it's possible and safe to do so. If some airlines choose to avoid the affected routes, others will surely be happy to take their place. And if such a scheme were to also show the benefits of innovations in air traffic control, quite a few have been suggested, the industry would end up better off as well as less polluting. That was Without a Trace. Fewer contrails would be good for the climate. Our final leader article, Cambridge Shame. Jason Arday was treated as a symbol, not a man. Both his supporters and detractors dehumanized the tragic fabulist. On August 14th, Jason Arday was found dead, apparently from suicide, at his home in London. For those who loved this 41-year-old Cambridge professor, it's a tragedy. For the world, it's a warning of the destruction bad ideas can wreak. The bad idea here is that people should be judged not by their individual character and abilities, but by their race, disability, or other politically charged attributes. Mr. Arday became the University of Cambridge's youngest ever black professor in 2023, before being engulfed by a scandal over plagiarism and faked research. He bore responsibility for his own downfall. Yet, just as troubling is the way both his supporters and detractors even now reduce him to a symbol. The most egregious is Cambridge, which used him to repair its reputation for being white and elitist. He did not deserve the glittering prize of a professorship there. His peers had for some time privately fretted that he lacked the credentials to support his public profile. Journalists at the Telegraph later found over 100 passages from his PhD thesis that had been copied, some with small changes, from someone else's. Others uncovered evidence in his public research of made-up quotes, data, and funding claims. Perhaps the university was hoodwinked by a con man, yet Mr. Arday's words paint him as a guileless fabulist. He spoke of visiting professorships at Glasgow and Ohio State. Both denied it. He described how he had run 30 marathons in 35 days, 9 with a broken leg. When asked about his extraordinary feats by the Guardian, he said, "I thought you'd just believe me." Cambridge seems to have been blinded by its eagerness to claim Mr. Arday as proof of its inclusiveness. But here is a star professor who was not only black, but had also overcome staggering disadvantage. Until he was 11, he claimed he could not speak. Until the age of 18, he was illiterate. He was also autistic. He was, in short, a walking, talking bundle of traits glamorized by people who want to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. Those who appointed him glossed over whether he was up to the job or to the scrutiny that would surely come with it. The man was subordinate to the symbol. Mr. Arday lied on a grand scale, and though vulnerable, dealt aggressively with any who questioned him. A journalist who asked about plagiarism was reported to the police for harassment. Mr. Arday enlisted ferocious libel lawyers to help quash the story. Those now blaming newspapers for his death and calling for more curbs on press freedom are continuing to treat his life as a morality tale. In fact, today's law helped Mr. Arday suppress legitimate questions of public interest. For Cambridge, hiring Mr. Arday was a handy substitute for years of sustained hard work. The share of black professors at the university remains a tiny 0.4%. Cambridge said it offered Mr. Arday support after he resigned. Given how things turned out, it should have taken its duty of care more seriously. Just as Mr. Arday's supporters dehumanized him during his rise, so his detractors rushed to use him as he fell. His case has delighted those who argue that all efforts to diversify institutions like Cambridge are wrong. The irony is that doubt may now fall unjustly on other academics for minority groups, precisely those whom activists supporting people such as Mr. Arday say they want to help. The fervor for DEI has already begun to pass by the time Mr. Arday was appointed. Since his death, pundits have debated what exactly he was a symbol of, peak woke or the rise of the digital lynch mob. He should be remembered as neither, but as a human being. And the institutions that failed him should try hard to look at people as individuals and their own virtues and flaws, rather than as emblems of anything. That was Cambridge shame. Jason Arday was treated as a symbol, not a man. You're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. If you missed any part of this program or any other of our great broadcasts, you can stream it from our website, sunsounds.org, or on our new SunSounds mobile app, available for both Apple and Android phones. Now, let's move on to our next article. I'll begin our selection of articles from around the globe with this one from Asia, No Room to Roam. Indian elephants are being squeezed out of their habitats, and court orders to protect them are ignored. In Arthashastra, an ancient Indian manual on statecraft, elephants were prized assets. Kings presented them to forge alliances. Generals relied on them to destroy the gates of forts. And today, Ganesha, the elephant-headed Hindu god, is still worshipped as the remover of obstacles, and children, as elsewhere, learn E is for elephant. But reverence has not translated into protection. A survey published last year by the Wildlife Institute of India counted 22,446 elephants, 18% fewer than in 2017. The decline in some states was a shocker, says Kamar Qureshi, the report's lead author. Part of the problem is geography. Unlike in Africa, villages are scattered throughout the forests of densely populated India. Elephants are often confined to narrow corridors between patches of forest. Vivek Menon of the Wildlife Trust of India says that in 2010, his team identified 88 such routes. Today, there are about 150, reflecting shrinking habitats. As infrastructure cuts through forest, elephants stray into farms. Mining and blasting sites also get in their way. In West Bengal, hula, or noise, parties see mobs hurl fireballs and firecrackers to drive the animals away, despite a Supreme Court ban. Electric fences sometimes block the elephant's path, but they're excellent physicists, says Raman Shamakar, an ecologist. They use their trunks, which are poor electrical conductors, to break fences or toss logs to short-circuit them. Forest guards and workers steering elephants back to safety are utterly unequipped and woefully unprepared, said Panarna Minda, a conservationist. Most lack basic equipment, such as torches. But not all is doom. Poaching for ivory has fallen since the 1980s. Coordination between state forestry departments and the national customs has improved. Today, India has a Wildlife Crime Control Bureau, and states have anti-poaching plans. Last month, India's Supreme Court upheld the removal of commercial activity from an elephant corridor in Tamil Nadu. Elephants act as landscape architects. They disperse seeds, shape forests, and fertilize soil. They keep wetlands alive by digging. Arthashastra advised India's rulers to protect forests inhabited by the magnificent beasts. Those in charge today would do well to take note. That was No Room to Roam. Indian elephants are being squeezed out of their habitats. From India, we move to China for this article, Eating Bitterness. Will China ever learn to love chocolate? Local chocolatiers are raising the bar. China has more coffee shop brands and more KFC branches than anywhere else on earth. But chocolate has never hit the spot, with the average Chinese eating 100 grams a year, a mere 100th of what a French person guzzles. A few mass-market foreign brands, Mars, Ferrero, Nestle, and Hershey, account for 4/5 of Chinese consumption. Of all the chocolate eaten worldwide, only 2% caresses Chinese taste buds. This may now be changing thanks to a handful of Chinese chocolatiers springing up around the country. Most are artisanal shops, but some are investing in supply chains and building big businesses. Take Choc Revive. Based in Shanghai, the firm was founded in 2023 by Xi Liang, a produce trader. He cannot open shops quickly enough. From 80 outlets now, he hopes to have 300 by the end of the year. Mr. Xi says that his company had 160 million yuan, that's 23.7 million US dollars, in sales last year, and he hopes to quadruple that or more this year. Choc Revive is trying to take chocolate local. It sources its own beans from Africa, but has set up an R&D unit in China and does its own roasting and grinding. Its big investments are intended to produce economies of scale, but the know-how it is accruing may spread and give rise to competitors. Another local chocolate company, Nibo, has been winning international awards for its creamy sweets. Saturn Bird, which started as a coffee grower in southwest China, is now planting its own cacao trees. Mr. Xi's concoction is 58 yuan for a 100-gram chunk, equivalent to a cheap meal for two. It's an awkward time to be selling premium products to belt-tightening consumers. Churning out the cheapest possible goods to undercut rivals is usually the formula. Milk tea brands are a case in point. Why are people paying out for chocolate? Mr. Cheese says that making chocolate with Chinese flavors such as longan, which is like a large lychee, seems to go down well. A simpler explanation is that at long last, Chinese people are learning to love the most delectable flavor in creation. That was eating bitterness. Will China ever learn to love chocolate? From China, we move to Africa for this article. Iro's Gambit. Somaliland wants to help secure the Red Sea. President hopes this will bring international recognition for the would-be state. Abdurrahman Mohamed Abdulli and is an ambitious man. In December of 2024, the 70-year-old former diplomat, who's better known as Iro, was sworn in as president of Somaliland, a breakaway republic that declared independence from Somalia in 1991. Last year, he was the would-be country's leader when Somaliland was formally recognized by Israel, the first nation to do so. The world has been ignoring Somaliland for 35 years, Iro tells The Economist. He wants outsiders to take a closer look. Iro's pitch centers on the Red Sea. The trade route has been a mess as of late, with shipping menaced by the Houthis, an Iran-backed militia that rules much of Yemen. Speaking this month during a visit to Nairobi, Kenya's capital, Iro says Somaliland can help secure the strategic waterway by offering military bases to global powers along its coastline. Once trade can flow unmolested again, he wants Somaliland's main port of Berbera to be the primary gateway to the markets of the Horn of Africa. Our message is that we are a responsible partner in security and trade, says Iro. He suggested that Somaliland could in effect be the new Djibouti. That tiny port state rakes in some $120 million a year by renting out slices of its coastland to foreign armies. America, China, and France, among others, have bases there. It also earns many multiples of that amount in annual port fees paid by landlocked Ethiopia, which depends on Djibouti for much of its international trade. Iro wants a slice of both Djibouti and cakes. He's trying to persuade Ethiopia to use Berbera, where the United Arab Emirates has built a new harbor, as its main outlet to the sea. It also wants to entice America to set up a military base there. That would give America more options if it chooses to resume its war against the Houthis, whom it bombed intensively last year. Access to military facilities around Berbera is widely believed to have been a part of a deal Israel struck with Iro when it recognized Somaliland last December. Some reports suggest that America and Israel may already be developing a military presence at Berbera with covert support from the UAE, which operates an existing base there. Iro denies such reports. There is no Israeli or American presence yet, he said. But the UAE has another base at the port of Bosaso in Puntland, a neighboring semi-autonomous province of Somalia, where unconfirmed reports suggest Israel is also embedded. As competition for military properties on the Red Sea heats up, Iro says he would be willing to offer both Israel and America bases at Berbera if they're interested. Next month, Iro will visit Washington, where he hopes to have a tete-a-tete with Donald Trump. Were that to happen, he would be the first president of Somaliland to meet directly with an American counterpart. We expect the recognition of the United States sometime in the future, says Iro, adding that Somaliland anticipates recognition at least from one more country before the end of this year. Iro's ambitions are ruffling regional feathers. Djibouti is irked by Somaliland's desire to barge in. Iro hints that his northern neighbor is trying to destabilize his country, presumably by supporting hostile militias on the border. Relations with Somalia are even more strained. Mr. Iro claims Somalia, which considers Somaliland a renegade province, has plans to mobilize troops along the southern frontier. This is not a peace recipe, he said. It does not help that Israel and Turkey, a patron of Somalia, are increasingly hostile to each other. Turkey has long been trying to mediate between Somalia and Somaliland, yet numerous rounds of talks in Ankara and Istanbul have failed. Next time they can happen in Tel Aviv, chortles Zero, who seems unbothered by the prospect of a proxy war. Yet America may well be reluctant to stir the pot by recognizing Somaliland. Houthis, meanwhile, have threatened to attack any Israeli military installation in the statelet. An American base there would become a target, too. That would shatter the reputation for peace and stability on which Somaliland has long built its case for international recognition. But there's nothing free in the world, said Iro. He seems willing to pay a price to put his country on the map. The question is, how high? That was Iro's gambit. Somaliland wants to help secure the Red Sea. Africa, we move to the United States for this article, Scoring Political Points. Why Conservatives Can't Stop Talking About Women's Basketball. WNBA has become a culture war battleground. The organizers of the Women's National Basketball Association, the WNBA, once begged journalists to cover it. The joke was that all you needed to attend a press conference was a camera and a question. Now it's standing room only. Much of that reflects the league's surging popularity. But it's also become an unlikely battleground in America's culture wars. Lately, the focus has been on Sophie Cunningham, a guard with the Indiana Fever, whom some have dubbed MAGA Barbie. Ms. Cunningham has not publicly identified as a Republican or a Democrat, but in an interview published last month, she said transgender women should be barred from competing in women's sports. Most Americans agree with her. Ahead of the midterms, though, the issue has become a fixture of right-wing politicians and commentators. For proof, look no further than Fox News, which generally pays little attention to women's sports. Between June 25th and August 11th, it devoted more than 200 segments to the WNBA. At least 130 of them on trans athletes, according to Media Matters, a left-leaning watchdog. The coverage has been so relentless that one of the network's biggest personalities, Jesse Waters, complained on air, "This is ridiculous." When, on August 8th, Ms. Cunningham was aggressively fouled by an opposing player, Dejanae Carrington, some conservative cast it as retaliation for her views. Florida Attorney General, a Republican, implied that the game had been played in his state, he might have charged Ms. Carrington with assault and battery. The foul brought another element of the saga into sharper focus, race. Ms. Cunningham is white. After the game, Ms. Carrington, who is black, posted on social media, "White privilege at Indiana Fever." She's not explained what she meant, but Caitlin Clark, another white Fever player and the league's biggest star, has also become a MAGA cause celeb. Last month, 11 Republican lawmakers wrote to the WNBA complaining that Ms. Clark was being pushed around on the court. They cited reports that this may be racially motivated. Donald Trump agreed that Ms. Clark has been treated rather rough. The league, for its part, has not always handled things well, at times asking fans to cover up shirts about trans athletes before reversing course. But it's also pointed out the absurdity of some of the coverage. There are no trans athletes in the WNBA. Two former NBA players and supporters of Mr. Trump claim to want to join. The league calls their efforts a publicity stunt. Why are Republicans pushing these buttons now? As the midterms approach, voters are focused on affordability, a problem for the party in charge. Race and trans issues offer more promising terrain on which to portray Democrats as out of touch. In June, conservatives won a victory at the Supreme Court, which ruled that states could bar transgender women from competing in women's sports. Meanwhile, the WNBA's attendance and viewership are booming. "Our focus is on basketball," said Ms. Clark recently. She's on a historic run, breaking records. That seems worthy of attention, too. That was Scoring Political Points: Why Conservatives Can't Stop Talking About Women's Basketball. Next, we cross the Atlantic for this European article. Not now, Mikhailo. An ex-minister calls on Volodymyr Zelensky to hold elections. Most Ukrainians oppose holding them, but democratic pressure is mounting. Late in the evening of August 18th, at the time when Ukrainians usually check their phones for warnings of incoming missiles, a video post seized the public's attention instead. The 9-minute address by Mikhailo Fedorov, who on July 15th was ousted as defense minister, was in part a final plea to be returned to his former post and in part a demand that Volodymyr Zelensky call elections. "We might not let Putin decide when Ukrainians choose their government," Mr. Fedorov said. "Democracy cannot be held hostage by Russia." The call for elections during wartime, which are explicitly prohibited under Ukraine's martial law, amounted to a direct challenge to the president, whom Mr. Fedorov has previously been careful not to cross. The intervention was a response to the announcement of a vote in parliament to confirm Mr. Fedorov's successor, General Yevheny Kamara. There was never much doubt that Mr. Kamara, a war hero held in high regard, would be voted in. In the event, the vote was 312-2. An earlier motion demanding the reinstatement of Mr. Fedorov had garnered just 3 signatures. Sources close to the ex-minister say he knew the chances of a return were slim, but that he felt compelled to call for an urgent reset of power amid a sense that the country was on a bad trajectory. But it's not clear how an election could work, either legally or practically. With hundreds of thousands of soldiers at the front, the logistical challenges would be immense and could render the results unreliable. Mr. Zelensky's staff said the video caught them unawares. It coincided with another headache for the president. On the morning of the parliamentary vote, Ukraine's anti-corruption agencies announced new lines of inquiry into some of his closest allies. Detectives say they uncovered a scheme to launder bail money for suspects detained in earlier investigations. The scheme, which the perpetrators called Operation Forrest Gump, allegedly implicated a state-owned bank and high-ranking figures in the presidential office. By day's end, Marina Mudra, a deputy head of the office responsible for sanctions, international tribunals, and the rule of law, had been charged and dismissed from her post. That the anti-corruption investigators came so close to Mr. Zelensky is embarrassing. It also suggests his ability to rein them in, angered as they are by his earlier efforts to shut them down, is shrinking. Previous anti-corruption investigations cost him key aides and a substantial share of his popular support. Yet polling shows Ukrainians remain overwhelmingly opposed to elections during wartime. Even among Mr. Fedorov's supporters, reaction to this proposal is mixed. To some, it looks impulsive. It could force Ukrainian politics into a treacherous situation ahead of the winter, in which Russia is expected to launch a drone and missile campaign of unprecedented ferocity. "If there's a plan, it's a bad one," said an MP, usually on Mr. Fedorov's side. Still, the intervention has put the question of elections back into public discussion. But at the moment, Ukrainians do not want them. But bombardment and political chaos might change that. That was Not Now, Mikhailo. An ex-minister calls on Volodymyr Zelensky to hold elections. And finally, we travel back across the Atlantic to South America for this article, Horsepower: Polo's Lessons for Argentina, Why the South American Country Dominates the Sport. 25 years ago, I came here for the first time," said Maximiliano Fernandez. "There was nothing. Now the area between the towns of Pilar and General Rodriguez, a strip of land 50 kilometers west of Buenos Aires, is packed with polo clubs, stables, and estates. Every scrap of farmland is being bought up and transformed into pristine polo fields. Argentina's polo world is a bubble within the country, says Mr. Fernandez, who manages a team. It has its own economy, and that economy is world-beating. Polo, or hockey on horseback as some see it, is purportedly the world's oldest team sport. An early version was played in Persia in the 6th century BC. The modern game was formalized by British officers in India and then galloped around the empire. It became the sport of kings, taken up by elites in Europe, the United States, and more recently the Gulf states. Yet Argentina came to dominate the global scene, even as the rest of its economy was in shambles. Like any fledgling industry, it helps to have raw materials. Horses have long thrived on the pampas, Central America's vast grasslands. They attracted gauchos, the local version of cowboys. Polo, when it arrived, fit naturally with the abundance of cheap horses, skilled riders, flat land, and agreeable weather. Argentine players were soon reckoned the world's best, and remain so. 27 of the top 30 professionals today are from that country. They sustain a service-based economy in which rich foreigners hire them to help win trophies. Industry soon followed. Landed Argentine families have built formidable breeding programs which pump out the world's finest polo horses, or ponies as they've known. And these products lead the field. Of the 1,140 horses that competed for the Queen's Cup in Britain last year, 1,000 were from Argentine bloodlines, according to the country's polo association. By maximizing its competitive advantage in human and equine capital, Argentina's polo economy has enjoyed an export-led boom. Between January and November last year, Argentina shipped 2,900 horses, three-quarters of them polo ponies, to 38 countries. The country is the world's leading exporter of horses. To keep their noses ahead, Argentine breeders and businessmen have invested in R&D and pioneered the cloning of ponies. A breakthrough came in 2010 when a clone of Dolfina Quartera, ranked the best pony in Argentine's Hall of Fame, sold for a record $800,000. Now, many are copies of past Argentine greats. Some breeders are attempting to trot a step further in order to protect their intellectual property, selling only the foals of clones rather than the clones themselves. Regulators have enabled the innovation. The Polo Association has resisted red tape and embraced technology, even as thoroughbred horse racing has prohibited it. But there is a limit. When Chiron, an Argentine biotech company, unveiled the world's first gene-edited horse in 2024, they were barred from competition. After all, such tech could one day enable rivals abroad to engineer horses that outrun even Argentina's famed bloodlines. At the same time as Argentina's economy bucks and rears, shrinking by 2.5% in February, growing by 2.8% in March, then contracting by 1.5% in April, the polo world seems unbothered. That's thanks in part to a steady flow of foreign direct investment. Rich foreigners, known as patrons, bring money aplenty into Argentina's polo bubble. They buy land, hire players, and haggle over horses, creating a trickle-down economy for grooms, farriers, trainers, vets, and architects. Sustained growth has been the result. Two decades ago, Juan Martin Bautista, an equine vet, worked almost entirely on racehorses. But today he works almost entirely on polo ponies. "I've never been busier," he said. Nor is the boom confined to Buenos Aires. From Cordoba to Patagonia, all over Argentina, you have so many more clubs, said Mr. Hernandez. The country now has 177 of them. The sports profile is rising globally too. Mentri, released in 2024, and a broadcasting deal with ESPN have brought it to new audiences. The approval ratings of Javier Milei, Argentina's president and a polo fan, are suffering as he attempts to reset the nation's economy. He might glance at proceedings in Pilar, a world-beating industry making the most of its competitive advantage, attracting foreign investment and adopting new technologies to bolster its position as the world's leading exporter. An ideal remedy, perhaps, for a long face. That was Horsepower, Polo's Lessons for Argentina. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the August 22nd weekly edition of The Economist magazine from Great Britain. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell, and it's been my pleasure to read them. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week for another edition of The Economist, and stay tuned for more interesting programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.